The EU supports the US return to the JCPOA as Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei has said Washington's return will mean something if the sanctions are lifted. The US acting Homeland Security Secretary becomes the third cabinet official to resign following last week's deadly storming of the Capitol. Also coming up, Cuba slams the Trump administration for, quote, political opportunism for placing the Caribbean country back on a blacklist of state sponsors of terrorism. Good to have you with us. Our top story, the EU foreign policy chief says the 27-member bloc supports the return of the United States to the Iran nuclear deal once President-elect Joe Biden enters the Oval Office.
We express our support to intensive diplomacy with the goal of facilitating a U.S. return to the JCPOA and Iran's return to full JCPOA implementation. We welcome President-elect Biden's positive statements on the JCPOA and look forward to working with the incoming U.S. administration.
In a statement, Borrell claimed the EU upheld its commitments under the deal, including sanctions lifting after the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the agreement in 2018. Last week, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said a U.S. return to the 2015 nuclear deal would be meaningful only if anti-Iran sanctions are lifted. Tehran has repeatedly slammed the European signatories for not fulfilling their commitments. Iran started to scale back its commitments under the deal and recently started enriching uranium to the 20% purity level. Meanwhile, the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency warned that Iran's higher enrichment of uranium means there are, quote, weeks left to salvage the agreement. Joining us is Ian Williams, a senior analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus from New York, and also Lawrence Davidson, a former lecturer at Westchester University from Westchester. Gentlemen, welcome. Ian, if I could start with you, the EU foreign policy chief Borrell showing a bit of optimism there about the US return, but Iran's leader has said that if the sanctions against Iran are lifted, then the U.S. return to the JCPOA will mean something. Otherwise, a U.S. return may be detrimental. What's your thoughts?
Well, it's a very complex situation. You've got Iran is half in and half out of the agreement, in the sense it's got an agreement with the Europeans, but not with the Americans. The Americans want to come back in. So at what point do you start? Is it to start with the original agreed low percentage refinement, or is it the current high refinement? Does Iran walk back on its current stockpile? Will the Europeans and the Americans accept that? From one point of view, if the Americans broke the deal, so they should, it's up to them to suck it and, live with it. From another point of view, the Iran could, as a matter of good faith, say, okay, well, now you're back, welcome, sanity's returned, and we will make some sacrifices for it. I think there's going to be a lot of give and take and jockeying, but these negotiations have never been easy. The Europeans are not a pushover. The Germans and the others were very strong on Iran at the time. I remember when this whole issue first came up. They were not pushovers and not pro-Iranian, but they were trying to get a realistic deal that protected everybody's interests and trying to resist immense pressure from the United States at the same time. And, of course, we know that they didn't resist that pressure. They didn't produce a working mechanism to bypass American sanctions. So it's... I think there's still a lot of negotiation and tugging and heaving, but I think there'll be a lot more goodwill. But you should also remember that Joe Biden's cabinet, like anything else in America, is filled with people who listen to what Israel says for their political futures. Not nearly as much as before, since Trump has run away with the Israel lobby. It means the Israel lobby is sort of scratching its head now and thinking, whoops, did we back the wrong horse? Well, they did. But whether that has practical, real political consequences in Washington is another story.
Okay. Lawrence, the EU foreign policy chief, also says or claims the EU upheld its commitments under the JCPOA since 2018. That's when the US unilaterally left the agreement. Did they? If you have an example, I would love to hear it.
No, I don't have an example. I don't think they did. Getting back to Washington, though, I think that the new CIA director, it was an interesting appointment. It's William Burns. He was, at least initially, part of the original negotiations with Iran. And his position is that the Israel will be safer with a nuclear agreement than without. So he's trying to cover his rear end, I guess, when it comes to the Zionists that way. But he also feels that the United States should withdraw from the Yemen situation, which would be quite welcome. And so essentially what his conception of this is a mutual drawback, a mutual ratcheting down, wherein you might be able to negotiate a step-by-step return or recreation of a situation which, in fact, meets everybody's interests. At least there's that kind of opening. There's two things that the Americans have to do. I mean, one is they have to move to remove to at least initially restructure downward any sanctions and eventually eliminate them, and they also have to get off of the backs of the European economy, so that if the Europeans want to cooperate with the Iranians, they don't have to face, you know, bank sanctions or whatever, financial sanctions. So the whole sanctions business goes first, of course, immediately to Iran. But I mean, the Europeans were under threat of sanctions as well with Trump. So that has to go. And I think eventually it will. I think that that eventually we will get back to some sort of acceptable platform where everybody is more or less satisfied.
Okay. Ian, the IAEA head has warned that there's only 3 weeks to salvage the agreement, in his opinion. Do you think that within that time frame, an agreement can be reached where the U.S. returns, lifts its sanctions as a condition of its returning to the deal? Do you see that happening?
I can't see an agreement being wrapped up in 3 weeks, and I think he's talking about a line in the sand that was drawn by people who have now blown away with the winds. So I think that line in the sand will be very flexible and blow away and flow like the dunes across the desert when the time comes, if there's serious negotiations going on. And who has an interest in triggering those? The Europeans accept that it's not Iran's fault, that they didn't break the agreement. Joe Biden is certainly not eager to press the issue. So I really can't see that being a real line in the sand for him. The IAEA has got to say so, because the UN specializes in drawing lines and then ignoring them when they get crossed over. So I think this is yet another line that's going to be crossed over, and the IAEA will just live with it and get into bona fide negotiations with a bit of tutting on the side. But since only the US wanted really to press this, I don't think the Europeans don't have a bomb in this fight.
Thank you very much indeed. Let's thank our guests for their contribution. Ian Williams is a senior analyst at Foreign Policy in Focus, joining us from New York. And Lawrence Davidson, a former lecturer at Westchester University, joining us from Westchester. Gentlemen, thank you for your contribution. Now, a wave of resignations is sweeping through the U.S. administration following the siege of the Capitol building by pro-Donald Trump's protesters. Acting Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf has said he's stepping down. He is the third cabinet official to quit his job in the aftermath of the attack. That comes amid a growing list of resignations by White House aides. In the meantime, counterterrorism prosecutors have opened probes into Wednesday's storming of the Congress building. The raid claimed at least six lives, including two police officers. Federal authorities have made dozens of arrests on several charges, including domestic terrorism. The FBI has also warned law enforcement officers of more armed protests being planned for Washington, D.C. and 50 U.S. capital cities ahead of President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration scheduled for January the 20th. The FBI, meanwhile, has warned of more armed protests and uprisings being planned for Washington, D.C., as well as dozens of other U.S. cities ahead of President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration. Earlier, we discussed the issue in detail with our guests in the News Review program. Let's take a listen to that. The FBI has reportedly warned of armed protests being planned for Washington, D.C. and 50 U.S. capital cities ahead of President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration. Reports say an identified armed group has said it plans to travel to Washington on January the 16th. The group has reportedly pledged an uprising in case of any attempts to strip Trump of his powers. Meanwhile, Washington's mayor has called for increased security around the January 20th inauguration ceremony. She made the call in a letter to the Homeland Security Department, slamming the insurrection on Capitol Hill as an unprecedented terrorist attack. The Pentagon has also been asked to review all members who will be part of the security detail for Biden's inauguration. Colin Campbell is our correspondent in Washington, D.C., and Matthew Fogg is a former chief deputy at the U.S. Marshals Service, also joining us from Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, welcome. Colin, what's the latest regarding this FBI bulletin?
Well, right now we know that the Washington Monument has been shut down because of credible intelligence that indicates that could have been under threat. Because of what intelligence officials are searching for online through various media, social media channels, they're finding that what happened last week was a coordinated effort to some degree, and that members of law enforcement may have been part of the problem of the mob that marauded through Capitol Hill and, of course, resulted in at least five deaths last week. So right now, what police are looking at, what FBI officials are looking at, and other intelligence officials are the way that some of these militiamen or domestic terrorists are organizing through social media online, and they hope to make a presence at the inauguration on that same day to try to disrupt the process. And so they've already made some preemptive moves to try to secure Congress, to secure various landmarks around Washington, D.C., and, of course, try to quell any of these dissenters, these violent, aggressive dissenters, from disrupting what has been tradition for many, many years, and, of course, to avoid any casualties in what could be another second insurrection in less than a month.
Matthew, you've got armed protests potentially in 50 state capitals. I was just asking you, how do you go about policing that, and what's the danger of that spiraling out of control?
Well, I mean, the bottom line is, I think there's enough law enforcement people in this country that we can handle these 50 states as far as the capitals are concerned, and these people. You got the National Guard, which each state can call out the National Guard, have them on call. You got state, local, and federal police. So there's enough manpower, I think, that we can deal with this. The problem is we should have been looking at this long time ago. We're reacting now because of what happened to the Capitol. That should have never happened at the Capitol. And again, the investigation is going to show that, as one of your caller just said, I mean, there was a lot of information showing that there were law enforcement people that were on the inside that was involved in that process. It takes me back to a day back in the early 90s when they had these good old boy roundups where racist groups in Tennessee where law enforcement people are a part of it. And the FBI has reported that there are a lot of white-wing racist groups that are part of law enforcement. So the problem that I see here is that there's got to be a purging of law enforcement to determine who in law enforcement is insurrectionist or is trying in some ways to change the government or take over the government. So you're going to have a lot of issues coming out of this, but I think there's enough law enforcement people right now, which are National Guard, that they should be able to ward off any type of assault especially on the U.S. Capitol.
Mr. Falk, thank you very much indeed. Let's thank our guests for their contribution. I'm afraid that's all we have the time for this edition of the News Review. Colin Campbell, our correspondent in Washington, D.C., and Matthew Falk, the former chief deputy at the U.S. Marshals Service, also joining us from Washington, D.C. Elsewhere, Cuba has slammed as political opportunism Washington's new sanctions and its decision to designate the Caribbean nation as a state sponsor of terrorism. In a Twitter post, the Cuban foreign minister condemned what he called the cynical and the hypocritical qualification of Cuba announced by Washington. That's after U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said he is placing Cuba back on the blacklist, adding that it sends a clear message to Havana to, quote, end its support for international terrorism and subversion of U.S. justice. The move is a reversal of an Obama-era decision and makes it harder for President-elect Joe Biden to quickly revive diplomatic ties with Havana. Since taking office in 2017, President Donald Trump has clamped down on Cuba by tightening travel restrictions and imposing sanctions, citing different pretexts. Biden has, however, said he would promptly reverse Trump's policies on Cuba. Political commentator Gloria Estela Lariva says Washington's policy on Cuba over the past 60 years shows the U.S. is the real state sponsoring terrorism.
Moved by the U.S. to declare Cuba, return it to the list of state sponsors of terrorism is absolutely cynical and ridiculous. It's the hypocrisy of the U.S. because everybody knows that Cuba is not sponsoring terrorism, that in fact it is the U.S. since the very beginning of the Cuban Revolution in 1959. The U.S. has sponsored, armed, financed, and given shelter to terrorists who have attacked Cubans on the island and in diplomatic missions abroad. More than 3,470 Cubans have been murdered, and 2,099 have been injured seriously by U.S. terrorism. In fact, the U.S. gave shelter to two of the most notorious terrorists in the Western Hemisphere. In all these 60 years, the U.S. has used biological warfare, spraying biological contaminants over the island, causing the death of hundreds, bombings of buildings in the island, bombing Cuban embassies and consulates in other countries, killing diplomats there, and most of all, carrying terrorism out in Cuba.
Turning to other news now, the coronavirus pandemic continues to wreak havoc across the United States as the country has reported more than 22,000 fatalities for the second consecutive week. Data suggests that on an average, the virus claimed over 3,200 lives per day in the world's worst hit country last week. New confirmed cases also hit a weekly high there. Over 375,000 Americans have lost their lives and more than 22.5 million others have tested positive since the outbreak of COVID. That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian News. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. What a dark night. Tonight, the moon is not showing itself, and the stars are shining like lanterns in the sky. Oh, look at there, the great bear. And just a little down, there is the lesser bear. How beautiful is the sky at night. I am in Maraghe now, a city in East Azerbaijan province. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to visit the Maraghe Observatory. Maraghe Observatory was built during the Ilkhanid era under the directorship of Khaja Nasiruddin Tusi in the city of Maraghe. Khaja Nasiruddin Tusi was an Iranian philosopher, religious thinker, Shia jurisprudent, mathematician and astronomer. Maraghe Observatory was not just a place for observing the stars. It actually used to be a vast scientific organization where the most important branches of science and knowledge were taught. The hill on which the Maraghe Observatory is located has different parts. Some of these parts include the central tower, the library, the residential quarter of scientists, the mosque, the school, the well, and a large workshop for scientists. I am now standing by the Maraghe Observatory, on top of a high hill. Here, there are great sceneries as far as the eyes could see. And wow, incredible! The Urumiye Lake is visible from this height. I am now standing by a huge dome, which is wholly covered by a white-colored coating. This coverage is made for protecting the building against the damage caused by rain, wind, and further destruction. There is also a ladder, which is used for going up the dome. However, I don't intend to go up the dome because I'm acrophobic. Now, let's go inside this magnificent white dome to see what's going on there. Thank you. The current monument of Maroghe Observatory is not used for astronomical purposes. Here, the remains of the main building of the observatory is seen. In this place, there used to be a cylindrical tower measuring 22 meters in diameter. One of the other unique characteristics of Maroghe Observatory is its multiple caves and underground corridors. Let's visit there. Oh my God! What a wonderful place! Here, there are several corridors which are connected to each other. Beside these corridors, there are chambers which have steep, triangular ceilings. Just in the middle of these chambers, there is something like a platform. Just imagine! At those times, there wasn't something like telescope, but Iranian astronomers had tools which could observe the stars by them. Until next time, goodbye!
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers, sisters, all over the world, assalamu alaikum, and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A, Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to answer some questions with regard to theology, and we are trying to cover different questions about the questions in religion and theology. Like always, an expert or speaker from Qom Seminary Schools has been invited to this show. Sheikh Murtada Karimi is in the studio. I'd just like to say salam to Sheikh and welcome him to the studio.
Wa alaikum salam, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome, Sheikh. Thanks for accepting the invitation. Today's question is a bit different with the questions that we had earlier, because this question is going to talk about the last Savior on the earth and the person that all the people are waiting for him, that is Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. It is said that what is the reason that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, Imam of the age, has not reappeared yet? What is the reason? What else should be done on the scene of earth to make the scene ready, to make the earth ready for his reappearance? It is being said that the earth should be full of oppression and tyranny that Imam will emerge. So don't you think that earth has been overwhelmed with tyranny and oppression till now? And can't we see the oppression that goes to the people in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in some Islamic countries, in Nigeria, in African countries, the oppression that different so-called superpowers are imposing on poor nations and weaker nations, and it makes people die, and it makes people to be killed? So what else is needed to be done to pave the way for the reappearance of Imam al-Zaman? Is it the same, as it to go and make this oppression more, as some believe, unfortunately, wrongly, based on some hadith, that they need to make the oppression more in the world so that they make the earth ready for the reappearance of Imam al-Zaman? So what is the reason of his absence? When will Imam be back to the world to save the humanity?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Some people think that the great amount of oppression that we have today is a good reason for Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, to reappear.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that if this was the case, then the Imam should not go into occultation to begin with. Because back then, at the time of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and before him, and the time of the other Imams, we have the same oppression prevalent in different parts of the world. When we are talking about Islamic territories, which oppression is more severe? The one that we see today, or the fact that the grandchild of the Prophet and his companions and his family members are killed and beheaded on the day of Ashura? This is a great oppression. Maybe no oppression can be compared to
that. Look, this oppression, no doubt that it was an oppression on the grandson of the Holy Prophet, but they were few in number. Let's say, for example, 72, not at most 100 people were killed and martyred there. But in today's world, we see that thousands of people are being killed every day. Do you think that they are comparable?
So I'm giving you some examples to come to this conclusion that the amount of oppression is not the cause of the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. I will come to the narration Kama Mula al-Zulman wa-Jawra or Ba'dama Mula al-Zulman wa-Jawra. So my point is that during the history of Islam, at the time of the tragedy of Karbala was limited to, let's say, 72 people. But during the Umayyad Caliphs, especially for the Shi'as, we have massacres of the Shi'a in different uprisings. For many years, Imam alayhi salam is cursed on the pulpit. The Imams are in prison. Whoever is named after the name of the Imam Ali alayhi salam or Imam al-Hassan or Imam Hussein, they are killed. In some period in the history of Islam and history of humankind, we have the invasion of the Mongols and some other dynasty that they made heinous crimes. When we are talking about Yazid, we know that how he killed the people of the city of Medina, so they were not few in number. My point is that oppression was already there, even before the occultation of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. And this occultation was one of the reasons that he went into occultation to save his life. So we have to take into consideration the fact that oppression in and of itself is not a reason for Imam Mahdi alayhi salam to reappear. When we read the history recently, we know that in World War II, about, I think, only in Iran, according to some statistics, 9 million people, they somehow were massacred out of hunger, according to some statistics. 9 million people. And in the World War I and the Second, we know that tens of million people were killed in different countries of the world.
This nine million in death toll in Iran was not because of hunger, because of a virus that was actually viral.
And there are different scenarios. As far as I know, one of the reasons was also a kind of fatigue, occurred in some parts of Iran, and it was a kind of oppression by the Western countries.
Very true. By UK.
Within
by British government.
Yeah, within few maybe months, only in one country, 9 million people, they you can see that they were massacred. Mm-hmm. It's not a natural death. So oppression has been there already.
True.
You can, I mean, if we imagine that time, World War the First and the Second, those people who were killed, and in our case, Islamic, I mean, the country of Iran, you see that compared to this time, maybe that oppression was greater. My point is that when we imagine all these cases, oppression in and of itself is not a reason for Imam Mahdi alayhi salam to reappear. Rather, what is mentioned in the narration is that kama mule'at zulman wa jawra, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will fill the earth with justice when the world is full of injustice. Now, the point is that at least to this time it has not realized. I mean, the fact that you cannot find any place in the world where justice is not applied. All the human beings are under oppression. This is not the case. I mean, it is true that many people, especially in Islamic countries, Yemen,
so we should not expect for the Imam to come in near future then?
Do not know about future. I mean, about the next year, about the following years, what I mean, the superpowers of the world are going to do. So, I mean, we cannot have a judgment about the future all the time. For according to the narrations, we should be hopeful for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. But the other point regarding that is the fact that, because some people, they say that in that case, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam has no benefit. He is in occultation, he's not helping the people, and many people are suffering. So what is the use of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam? We have it in the narrations comparing Imam to the sun beyond the clouds.
Yeah.
Now the point is that Imam at least has two functions. One of them is government, and the other is imamate and helping the people through different ways. Although Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, because he is in occultation, he does not have the function of government and running a government, but he is the imam of the people. According to our narrations, imam, if the earth is without the divine proof, there would be no human being on the earth. Everyone will perish. And there are different cases, at least, that we can make sure that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is helping the people. In a narration from Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, he himself says that I'm not, I mean, negligent about your affairs.
Yeah.
And some examples can be mentioned in the history of Islamic Republic of Iran in the 8-year imposed war. You know, the Quran says about the divine help for the Muslims in the Battle of Badr, for example, those angels who helped the Prophet,
yeah,
and the companions of the Prophet. So how come we could imagine that Islamic Republic of Iran, with all those problems, was able to resist all the superpowers in the world? It was not only through, physical ways and natural ways. How the Yemeni people, with all this problem, now are able to not only resist the Saudi Arabia and all the Western countries, but also to have an upper hand in this war. We can think about the people in Lebanon and in some other countries.
Yeah.
So the point is that, at least as Shia, we can make sure that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, through spiritual ways, is helping the people who are trying their best.
So, Sheikh, what is the good of an imam who is absent and he's not among his followers then? You said that some of the benefits of imam, but these are spiritual. Can they be interpreted or, let's say, explained for the people who just know what is tangible, what can be sensed? Is it a good way to, for example, tell them, look at spiritual help that imam gives to you, and he does so-and-so, and you do not understand what... Well, it is difficult to be proof, Sheikh, for ordinary people with materialistic worldview.
First of all, it is important for us to know who is asking this question. We are not answering, non-Muslims because they do not believe in Mahdi. We are not answering our Sunni brothers because they do not believe in a person who has been born. Yeah. We are answering the Shia who have asked this question. So already they believe in all these concepts that we mentioned. Without an imam, the earth would not continue to live. The creatures would stop living on the earth.
Thank you very much.
And the second point is that it's not only spiritual. All these examples that I mentioned, imam is helping spiritually speaking, but the results and the effects are tangible. The victory of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the victories of Yemenis, Lebanese people, all these Shias, the results are tangible.
The results are tangible, but can they be applied to the help of an imam? This is something else, because imam cannot be seen, and people say, okay, this is Allah's will that wanted to help the Muslims.
I told you, if you're answering a Shia,
yeah.
So because of the narrations that we have, we can make sure that this divine help is coming us through the imam, which is a kind of intermediary between us and Allah.
One more short question, Sheikh. You said that we have not yet seen those oppressions, and it takes time, for example, for the world to be full of oppression and tyranny. So does it mean people should wait for more oppressions and more tyranny to come, and then so it's going to be the world going to be darker than whatever it is? And then is there any possibility to interpret the hadith and narrations that even there is a possibility for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to make it overnight, to make the world prepared for the imam to come without this oppression? Is it possible also?
This is a very important topic. We need to, inshallah, talk it separately. But to put it in a nutshell, imam, first of all, after when the world is filled with injustice, imam alayhi salam appears. But second of all, according to the narrations, imam also needs some people to help him. Because some people, as you mentioned, think that imam Mahdi alayhi salam will overcome his enemies out of a miracle. No. I mean, through natural ways, Imam alayhi salam will defeat the enemies. And he must be helped in the first circle by 313 people.
Yeah.
In the second circle, it must be thousands of people, because sometimes people think that Imam Mahdi is waiting for 313 only. It's not the case. I mean, these 313 people are the first circle around the Imam. I mean, those people who will act as maybe the commanders. But then we need many other people to help Imam Mahdi. So the inhabitants of the earth should also prepare themselves to be able to help Imam Mahdi alayhi salam for his cause.
Thank you very much. Inshallah, we shall continue this question and discussion in our upcoming session. Thank you, Sheikh. And you respected listeners, many thanks for your listening to Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRB English Radio. I leave in Allah's protection. Join us in our next session. Till then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Inna fi al-jannati nahran laban. Inna fi al-jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Li Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
On Wednesday, 6th of January 2021, a day the world will not soon forget, hundreds of supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump besieged the U.S. Capitol in a serious attempt to overturn the results of the controversial election of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris as the next president and vice president of the United States. We now present you an article written by Kelebogil Zabobko under the heading, "This is Not Who We Are, is a Great American Myth." The article has been taken from foreignpolicy.com website. Please stay with us for more of Kelebogil Zabobko's article. George Floyd was killed by U.S. police officers in Minneapolis, Minnesota, after allegedly using a counterfeit $20 bill at a neighborhood store. Breonna Taylor was killed in her home by police officers while sleeping in Louisville, Kentucky. Ahmed Aubrey was lynched by a trio of neighborhood vigilantes whilst jogging in Glynn County, Georgia. In 2020, Americans protesting structural racism and anti-black violence with tear gas, pepper spray, pelted with rubber bullets, misrepresented as threats to the public peace, and subjected to arbitrary arrests in cities across the United States. Then, on Wednesday, 6th of January 2021, a day the world will not forget soon, hundreds of supporters of outgoing President Donald Trump besieged the U.S. Capitol building in a serious attempt to overturn the result of the controversial election of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris as the next president and vice president of the United States. After rushing doors, breaking windows, and charging through the halls of Congress, the insurrectionists sat in the Senate president's seat, put their feet up on the House Speaker's desk, ransacked congressional offices, and defaced statues. The consequences? A remarkably small number of arrests and even some selfies with security officers. The recent events reflect a double standard between how law enforcement responds to different groups based on their race. Last year, Black Lives Matter protesters were overwhelmingly peaceful, but were subject to ill-treatment by the authorities and smeared as rioters and looters. By contrast, some conservative politicians and news media have denied, excused, and even defended the pro-Trump insurrectionists who attempted to seize the citadel of U.S. supposed democracy and managed to walk away from the scene. Policymakers, academics, and citizens have long decried the discrepancy in the treatment of black people and people of color more generally in comparison to white people in the United States. In policing, employment, housing, healthcare, and many other areas, this inequality has adverse consequences for democracy. It sharpens social cleavages, normalizes the marginalization of certain groups, and limits the full and equal participation of all the peoples in political, economic, and social life of the United States. The anti-democratic behavior and racism that have defined the Trump era should be addressed through transitional justice. First, so that Americans can develop a shared understanding of their political past and present. And second, so that there can be justice for all. Over the last few days, the U.S. media and political leaders have repeated the refrains, "This is not who we are," and "This is not America," again and again. This is not who we are. This is not America. To the contrary, This is in fact, and in essence, America. But a foundational flaw in the U.S. national project is its citizens' inability to unite around a common understanding of reality, notably in terms of structural racism and systemic injustice. This divide increasingly falls along partisan lines. The recent assault on the Capitol building shows that it is well past time for the United States to confront its troubling past and present. It is well past time for transitional justice to address discrimination, to address violence and abuse of power by government and non-government actors alike. While transitional justice is often applied by governments in new democracies and post-conflict countries, the framework could prove valuable in the United States, which has a long list of unaddressed violence and abuse, generally connected to racism and other systems of oppression. Transitional justice can help the United States address two pressing issues simultaneously, that is, anti-democratic behavior and historical and contemporary racism. Donald Trump and his enablers catalyzed the anti-democratic riot at the Capitol after months of peddling claims about illegal votes, faulty voting machines, and ballot theft and disposal. Ethnic antagonism among many Republicans underlies these attacks. Republicans are overwhelmingly white, report being concerned about the growing presence and political power of Americans of color and their demands for a more free, more just and equitable society. In a national survey conducted in January of 2020, political scientist Larry Bartels found that 51% of surveyed Republicans believe that the traditional American way of life is disappearing so fast that they may have to use force to save it. 47% agreed that strong leaders sometimes have to bend the rules in order to get things done. And 41% agreed that a time will come when patriotic Americans have to take the law into their own hands. These figures may be even higher now. Transitional justice could address these beliefs in part by punishing those who have taken the law into their own hands and deterring those who would do so in the future. As part of a transitional justice response to anti-democratic actions, elected U.S. officials must dispense with theories of election fraud, and those who have encouraged them should be held accountable under the law. When the Democratic-controlled Congress convenes after the inauguration on 20th of January, it should begin hearings on election disinformation. All federal officeholders who contributed to election disinformation and who incited violence, including Donald Trump, and the 147 Republicans who voted to overturn the election should be served with congressional subpoenas that compel them to testify under oath at risk of perjury to the purported truth. The 2020 election was safe, it was secure, and free and fair. Their constituents should hear the truth from them directly. Should subpoenaed individuals fail to comply or lie under oath, the punishment is very simple. They should be indicted and tried for obstructing justice and lying to Congress. Wednesday, 6th of January's insurrectionists and all who engage in similar violent acts with the intention to upend the so-called democracy should also be arrested, charged, and tried. Otherwise, Americans will likely see similar assaults on democracy in the coming weeks, months, and years. The U.S. Congress should also seek to curtail presidential pardon powers so that leaders cannot pardon themselves, their relatives, or their close associates. Self-serving pardon powers have become a definite feature of the Trump administration, and many Trump allies are banking on being pardoned for misdeeds carried out in his service. Second, to confront America's racist past and present, the country could turn to a truth commission, such as one sponsored by Representative Barbara Lee and Senator Cory Booker, to establish certain basic facts for the nation. Systemic inequality is a defining feature of American democracy, as is white privilege. Both explain disparities in U.S. political, economic, and social life, including how demonstrators are portrayed and treated by law enforcement officers. Whether through a truth commission or through another set of congressional hearings, the United States must dispense with whataboutism and the false equivalencies drawn between social movements such as the Black Lives Matter movement and the rioters at the Capitol. It is essential to clarify that whilst the Black Lives Matter promotes racial equality and inclusion, Donald Trump's Make America Great Again movement focuses on white supremacy and on exclusion. Last summer's Black Lives Matter protesters were lawful and motivated by noble goals such as ending police brutality and impunity for perpetrators of racial violence. The pro-Trump insurrection, though, was at its core violent and illegal, and it was motivated by an ignoble goal: undermining democracy and subverting the will of an increasingly diverse people. The Biden administration and the new session of Congress must quickly counter the attacks on democracy and on marginalized groups that have characterized the Trump presidency. The time for truth and the time for justice is right now.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.